This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
Chris Berry of Downs says it's too late to plant corn. Why not plant hemp? But it's not that easy to grow.
It's kind of a weak plant when you grow for fiber. You end up babying it for the first, I would say, 6 to 8 weeks.
More on hemp and how to do it from a McLean County producer. Plus an update on enrollment and the budget at Heartland Community College. And a preview of the inaugural Black Dirt Music Festival in Bloomington. After a GLT news update, this is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The Heartland Community College Board has approved a tentative $32 million operating budget for next year. That includes about a 6% increase in salaries, and it's the second year of planned deficit spending. President Keith Cornell says those deficits will end, they hope, as a planned realignment continues in what Heartland does and how it does it. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker and Heartland Vice President for Finance Doug Minter, Cornell says the long-term strategic plan projects growth while being stable and furthering the economic development of the area.
There was a Georgetown study that was recently done that said by 2020, 65% of all jobs in the U.S. would require some sort of post-secondary education, but not as much as a bachelor's degree. Generally, some college or to the level of an associate's degree. So the type of education and training we provide here at the institution. And when we, in the past year, took a look at our district, what we found was that 58% of the population over the age of 25 years old in our district are lacking that level of educational attainment. And when we took a little deeper dive into it, we found that 7.8% of those residents over the age of 25 in our district don't even have a high school diploma.
How is that shaping and changing what you're trying to do?
So what that means is that we've kind of said we need to do some things with our program to shift and address several needs. One is the academic portfolio, the things that we offer at the college. Currently, the college offers about 84% of our credits are generated in the transfer side of the house. We want to keep a strong transfer program, but balance that out with career and technical education programs so that we come closer in line with the other community colleges across the state.
And how many years will it take you to rebalance?
I think it will probably take us, we'll start to see a gain, not in this first year, but in the second year we'll start to see a gain with some of the programs that we put in place. So we'll be putting in what we're calling work-ready programs, programs that respond to the workforce needs. The first program that we have coming online will actually be this fall with a medical assistant program. And part of what we're doing is we're shifting staff in order to have an office related to work ready and innovation. In other words, a unit that will develop the curriculum that really is thinking about the current job needs as well as those future job opportunities that are just starting to crest and are going to be those type of jobs of the future that sometimes people say we don't know about today.
Change is rough. What is that going to mean for your personnel alignments? Who will have to either do something different or leave?
And that's part of what we've been doing with the reorganization. As we have had vacancies, we've realigned them, and we've shifted duties and responsibilities of folks, primarily in the student service areas, enrollment areas, and then with this new work-ready concept. So some folks have new jobs, and we have created a few new positions in order to have the staffing that we believe objectives for stronger enrollments.
What are those new positions?
Some of those new positions are an executive director for Work Ready and Innovation, a curriculum person in that area as well, so somebody that can just start to develop, working with the faculty, developing those types of programs that are addressing workforce needs. We also have another staff that we have shifted in order to provide support, logistics, and data review for that area. We've also have done a few things different with our regional campuses or centers so that we can better meet the needs in those communities as well.
Will this eventually be employment neutral, or will you shrink your workforce?
We will not be shrinking our workforce. We're reassigning work, and we do anticipate that we will have several new positions.
Sometimes in the midst of change, certain sectors go down and decline, at least temporarily. Are you experiencing that in the first year, and do you expect to see lower credit hours or lower enrollments in certain areas as you shift?
Not necessarily, because I think the shifting of the credit hours that we're looking at are in areas that we have not have had significant enrollments in the past. So what we're trying to do is add in the career and technical education areas, which is where we have that opportunity for gain. Generally, many of those programs, as we design them, will also be attracting the older audience, if you will, those over 25 people that maybe are underemployed right now or looking for new opportunities, people that have not been engaged with the college. So we believe that, and with our strategies, we're seeking a new market sector that has not previously been served as well by the college. Also, with some of our areas where we know that we've had underserved population, looking at data, it will allow us to get into those communities and grow the populations in those areas as well, or enrollments in those areas.
Like where and like what?
Well, we do know that we don't have a significant number of enrollments in Logan County. I'll use that as an example. And so I think we have an opportunity to gain enrollments in Logan County. We also know that that's a higher area of, the educational attainment is lower there than here in McLean County. So I think it offers an opportunity for us to do some things to improve people's skills and then moving them into career-related type of trainings and courses.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Keith Corneal, the president of Heartland Community College, and with Doug Minter, the vice president for finance at Heartland, about the tentative new budget approved yesterday by the Heartland College Board. How about the actual dollars? What does the new budget look like?
The salary line increases by about 6%. But that is a combination of a number of things, including typical across-the-board annual salary increases, some of the reorganization work that Keith has described, an effort that's been underway for at least 18 months called our Position Framework Alignment Project, which is striving to gain more market competitiveness for positions across all ranks, and includes an allowance for the first wave of the minimum wage implementation, and then we also have some obligations for people retiring. So there's a number of things in there, all included in that roughly 6 or 6.4% increase.
What's the cost of living increase for the people not already accounted for by collective bargaining?
So, of course, we don't call it that. Typically, our across-the-board increase follows the faculty contract. But that rate this year is 2.5%.
Personnel is always the most expensive thing in any budget for an institution of higher education. So what is the total dollar increase?
For all salaries in the operating budget, including benefits, because we also had some higher benefits. We had a higher increase in our benefits rates this year that also hit.
Why is that?
We are a self-insured organization. So the premiums that we collect from employees and that we contribute to the self-insurance fund, we manage that fund, and then our provider, Blue Cross Blue Shield, provides to us an estimate, actual estimate of what we should charge. charge in rates, and our experience with that is normally very accurate. This particular year, we had an unusually high number. The target was off. We were around 25%, 20 to 25% higher on claims than we were on premiums collected, so that resulted in a higher rate increase.
A lot of self-insured risk pools have a cap. Are you one of them, or are you direct?
Absolutely.
If you didn't have that cap and that protection, what would have been the increase?
It was around 29%, I believe.
So you're going to hope for a good year next year on that front. And again, what's the total increase?
About just shy of $1.4 million.
Okay, out of a total budget of?
The grand total operating budget is $32 million in expenditures.
And let's unpack that. How much of that comes from the state? How much from tuition? Give the listeners a chance to see how you're put together there.
We always like to qualify this, that the original model that was envisioned in the 1960s for community colleges was based on one-third tuition fees, one-third state support, one-third local support, and the operating budget that we're presenting this year. Tuition fees is at 50.5%, state support is 8.2%, local support is 34.6%, and then all other is 6.7%.
And other would be corporate support or individual grants, federal grants, that sort of thing?
The largest portion of it, I think, is continuing education courses, the non-credit offerings, as well as some other like federal grants and such.
Is that ratio that you just laid out, that pie chart, relatively unchanged, except for the recent four-year period when the state finances were in the toilet?
I think we're seeing an increase in the percentage on tuition and fees. State support, if you set aside the volatility that we've had in the last couple of years, that's probably pretty close. In fact, state support might be a little bit higher in recent years.
Well, this is the second year of a budget that's been delivered. So what hath the General Assembly wrought for you?
We do not know yet, because those appropriations on a by-college basis have not been released.
How is the state capital bill going to help or affect Heartland Community College?
There's nothing in the most recent capital bill other than a restoration of a Challenger Learning Center project, remodeling project that was put on hold when the state budget crisis hit, and that's about $86,000.
Well, that's small enough that it might appear rather quickly, but a lot of those projects are deferred until the revenue starts coming in.
We are not going to revive activities on that until we have more tangible evidence of the funds flowing.
What can property taxpayers expect?
We won't set the levy until later in the year, but this budget is predicated on not increasing taxes.
Doug Minter is the Vice President for Finance at Heartland Community College. Thank you, and thanks to Keith Corneal, the President of Heartland Community College. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Heartland says nearly 88,000 people in McLean, Livingston, and Logan counties have less than an associate's degree. That's 58% of the population. And nearly 12,000 people in the three-county area have no high school diploma. That's close to 8% of the population. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Mackinac Valley Vineyard and Winery, open daily. Offerings include wine tastings, gift shop, outdoor concerts Saturday evenings, special events, and space available for private parties, weddings, and wedding receptions. MackinacValleyVineyard.com, wine country in your own backyard. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Illinois Wesleyan University alum Jack Sigma has had a pretty good couple of weeks. He just got back to Bloomington after taking part in the Toronto Raptors NBA Championship Parade. Sigma is a consultant for the team. This comes 2 months after Sigma was elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame for his 14-year playing career that included 7 All-Star appearances. Sigma tells GLT's Eric Stock, getting that call to the hall has been life-changing.
Well, it was quite a thrill, first of all, to get the call. I was excited about being considered, and when you get a call where you're being recognized by your peers as one of the best, it's exciting. It's humbling. A lot of looking back at my life and thinking about all the different people that had an effect on not just my life, but particularly with basketball. It can get a little overwhelming.
Well, a lot of times it's that early foundation that lays the groundwork for success. And as we stand here on the Illinois Wesleyan University campus, we're going back a few years, but how did your time here, your 4 years in Bloomington, mold you into first the basketball player that you became, but the man that you became?
Well, I had a great 4 years here at Wesleyan. You know, I grew up in St. Anne, and our basketball team had some success there, and going through the recruiting process, Coach Bridges had a huge impact on my life. I made a commitment here and trusted Coach, who just said, Jack, I don't know how good you can be, but we're going to find out if you're willing to put in the work, and I'll make that commitment to you that I'll do whatever I can to help you achieve your goals. And that's what worked out. I mean, I got a chance to play right away. We were very competitive. I developed my game here. The inside pivot came about because Coach recommended that I build a go-to move in the post, and you know, it became the foundation of my offensive game. And so again, huge impact on my basketball career. And again, like I said, my 4 years here were great 4 years, made a lot of lifelong friends, and have fond memories.
And that became a patented move, sort of your signature move that became your trademark in the NBA.
Yes. Again, I was a skinny kid. Even here, I was still, I don't think in my sophomore year I was 200 pounds, but I was 6'10", 6'11", and I needed to find something which was effective in the post, where it wasn't necessarily a power move, but a move that fit my skill set. And so we worked hard at trying different things, and the inside pivot is what came about. It gave me some room to get my shot off. I was a decent shooter for a big guy, and it fit my game really well, and it really put some pressure on the defensive player. They had to decide whether they were going to get into me and crowd me, or in which I'd put the ball on the floor and go around them, or if they didn't, I shot over them.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Jack Sikma, Illinois Wesleyan alum and a soon-to-be Basketball Hall of Famer, who will be speaking at the YMCA Legacy Dinner on Thursday night at the Bloomington Country Club. When you were young, growing up, was there a YMCA that you were a part of that you recall, or did you have a relationship with the YMCA when you were young?
I did not when I was younger. And again, I grew up in a farm town, and I think the closest YMCA was probably in Kankakee. But I did have a relationship with the YMCA when I was with the Supersonics, and it was really a relationship between the NBA and the YMCA, in which every year, I think two or three times a year, the players would go to a YMCA in the area and speak with the kids and do a little basketball clinic. And so had an opportunity to be involved. And again, I know the good work of the YMCA, and so I'm looking forward to the event on Thursday night, and looking forward to sharing some of my experiences with the crowd, and hopefully they'll enjoy it.
Youth sports is so much more structured now than it was when you were growing up, and even when I was growing up. Is that a good thing?
In some ways, it's a good thing, and I still hope that kids learn how to just get together and kind of put their games together. I think there's a benefit to that, too, where they have to, you know, be organized and take some leadership and just have some fun, where it's not necessarily always keeping score, but just going out and enjoy it among their friends.
Shifting to college athletics, it's also a different scene than it was when you were in college. It seems to be much more of a big business now. It's hyper-competitive. There's a lot of money in it. If you were in charge, how would you do things differently, or anything that you would like to see differently about the college game?
You know, there's a lot of people that are really smart that are involved in it. Again, the reason is, again, it starts with the exposure. There's a lot of space filled in media at a bunch of different levels. And again, the whole explosion of from streaming to Twitters to whatever, everybody can kind of have a comment on it, and that space is a big space to fill. Again, that kind of just feeds on itself. There's issues. You know, it's not perfect. The money definitely is huge, but it's not totally broken. You know, and like I said, I'm not in tune with it enough, other than being a fan, and I have my thoughts, but there's good people running that.
And going back to the NBA, 2 years removed from Illinois Wesleyan, you win an NBA championship with the Supersonics. 40 years later, you're part of a championship team on a more limited role, of course, as a consultant with the Toronto Raptors. So what was that like?
It's been really a great year. You know, there was some changes with the Raptors. They've had we've had some success over the last few years. But when it came to the playoffs, we ran into LeBron a few years and just couldn't get over the hump. The whole acquisition of Kawhi Leonard has kind of changed I don't know, the approach and what was maybe achievable. He had a unbelievable playoff run. And Canada, the whole country of Canada and the Toronto area was just crazy for the Raptors. And there was a lot of big moments in a number of different games that the Raptors were able to come through and win it and win series after series. And that's where my memories of 40 years ago was always a play here or there that made a difference in these games. And you just got to be focused. And I'm happy for our guys. It's well-deserved. They were very determined and focused all year long, and they believed they could get it done, and they did.
Here with Jack Sigma, who is soon to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Have you written your speech yet?
I have not, but I've got on my phone, I've got a place in which I write thoughts down in, and I'm also on YouTube. Fortunately, you can go and listen to some of the other guys' speech, and I think the important thing right now is just to kind of get a little bit of an organization as far as what points you want to hit and talk about and what's important to you. But it'll come, and the Hall of Fame has done a wonderful job. The people there know that it's a huge thing for an inductee, and they provide so much support. And I'm probably maybe after the 4th of July is when I'm going to tackle it. And the Hall wants you to. They put a goal down. I think it's the middle of August. They want you to have your speech done so you don't have to worry about it. You know, you don't need any more pressure. So it'll get done.
You'd referenced the low post moves that you are known for. You're also known for your long, curly hair. If you haven't seen it, you can YouTube it. But what do you want to be remembered for?
I want to be remembered for my durability and my ability to do a number of things on the court. And I played in an era where there was a lot of great centers and a lot of them in the Hall of Fame. And I appreciate the opportunity to compete against such great players at the highest level. And it made me a better player because of it. At the time, it was a huge challenge, but I feel real fortunate to have had a chance to play against the greats.
And lastly, what's next for you? You're still involved in the game as a consultant. Anything else on the horizon for you, basketball-wise or otherwise?
My goal is to stay connected with the game. I don't necessarily want to do it full-time, but I haven't ruled that out either. But we'll see. I need a little structure in my life, but I don't need full time. We have a son that plays over in Europe. We always like to get over there and a couple times a year watch him play and spend some time with him. Got a lot of friends and I get out and play golf a couple times a week and enjoy that. So have some freedom, but still stay connected to the game in some manner is my goal.
That was Illinois Wesleyan University alum Jack Sikma with GLT's Eric Stock. His induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame is set for September 5th through the 7th in Springfield, Massachusetts. This Saturday, Sikma will throw out the first pitch at the Cubs game at Wrigley Field. Fellow Wesleyan alum Wayne Mesmer will sing the national anthem. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. There's a lot of excitement about opportunities to grow industrial hemp in Illinois, but not a lot of knowledge. Hemp is a type of cannabis plant that includes very little of the active ingredient that makes people high when they use marijuana. Tim Shelley and Charlie Schlenker have this report.
More than 600 applications have come into the state, more than 250 in the first week of eligibility. Chris Berry is a hemp farmer in Downs and vice president of the Illinois Hemp Growers Association.
By any measure, it's a great turnout. And a lot of states didn't even reach 200 applications in their first year. Illinois had it in the first week. And it's a good variety. People are growing for fiber, seed, and flower. But I think a majority of it's growing for flower.
But Barry says there are challenges in this new Illinois marketplace. He says if you're growing for fiber seed or, again, flower, the problems and even the equipment changes.
They're all pretty sensitive crops, the way you have to harvest and handle the seed and fiber. And then for the flower, a lot of times you don't want to direct sow into the field. You want to do transplants. So it's very much like growing tomatoes or other vegetables. It's kind of a weak plant when you grow for fiber. You end up babying it for the first, I would say, 6 to 8 weeks. From there, it becomes a lot more sturdy and a lot more resistant. A lot of farmers, they're learning how to deal with this crop. They have no idea of what kind of equipment they even need to do it. But when I tell them, well, when you're doing fiber, it's more like a hay operation. When you're doing seed, it's more like an oil seed operation. And when you do flower, it's more like organic vegetable farming. And a lot of farmers, they weren't aware that you need to grow especially the flower crop, organically. You shouldn't have any pesticide in your soil. There's no approved pesticide or herbicide that you can use on the plants. And also the plant itself will suck up that pesticide, and you'll see the residue of that stuff in the finished product. So if you're selling it as sort of a medicinal or health supplement product, people are going to want to see that residue, especially the extractors, the businesses that take it to the oil. They're gonna be able to tell that there's residue in there, and they either will not accept the crop or they will lower the price on you.
Barry and his wife grow on about 10 acres near Downs. He says the online licensing process has been very easy.
And you check some boxes that says I agree to let the Department of Ag come test our crop, and I understand that if it exceeds 0.3 THC, then it must be destroyed, things like that. Then they've got this handy tool where you can draw, it's like a GPS tool where you can draw a box around the property that you're going to be growing on. It'll tell you exactly the size of the acreage that you have, and it sends that map right to the Department of Ag.
Barry says the State Medicinal Plants Bureau has been very prompt. Some farmers, Barry says, have received approval in just 5 hours. Now, this has not been a great year for Illinois. Too wet. Many farmers haven't been able to get corn in. Barry says hemp, it's a good year and a bad year this year.
Hopefully we'll have really good weather for the rest of the summer for growing flower crops. We're going to get a late start, but usually you only grow the plants 8 weeks vegetative, and then you go into flowering, and you're probably only going to grow 5-6 weeks flowering. We should be able to harvest still by October, early October or mid-October. And then with the seed, you're probably going to get less of a result there, because with the seed crop you want to grow all the way through maturity, and that can take up to 120 days. And then with the fiber crop, it's actually pretty interesting. A lot of farmers will not plant their corn this year, and that leaves an interesting opportunity for growing fiber crops, especially in the next 2 weeks. If you plant by late June, you can still get a good crop. And the fiber crop, the life cycle is only about 60 days until it reaches the point where you're going to chop it down. So there's still a good opportunity for farmers to get into fiber. So that's what I would recommend. If anybody out there wants to grow something this year, look into growing hemp fiber.
Barry says it could be a good idea to test the hemp market this year because next year it will be huge. He says he's heard the supply of flour for oil is about 10% of the demand, and that market, Barry says, will not be saturated for some time. Most farmers, he says, will start small.
We've kind of bit off as much as we can chew with 10 acres. I would recommend between 1 and 3 if you have no experience growing the cannabis plant at all. That's for the flower, but if you want to do a fiber crop, you can definitely plant it out 10, 20 acres at a time, because it's more of a row crop style, so you can seed direct into the ground, and you just cut it down with a sickle bar mower and windrow it and bale it up.
Barry says he's had people reaching out to him nearly daily since January, asking questions and needing a little nudge. He says step one is to get your soil tested.
Well, if you're going to grow a fiber crop, the fertility doesn't have to be outstanding. It's very similar to like a corn fertility, maybe a little bit less on the nitrogen. For seed and flower, you want to have pretty rich soil.
Chris Berry also says as the crop changes from vegetative stage to flowering stage, the nutrient needs change as well. So farmers may want to do a two-step fertilization to better control what the plant gets. With Tim Shelley, I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Chris Berry says his own group, the Illinois Hemp Growers Association, Cornell University, Purdue University, and the Canadian Hemp Trade Alliance are all good resources to explore the world of hemp. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Monkey Duck Marina, just a little beyond normal on Lake Bloomington, offering pontoon, bass boat, canoe, and kayak rentals for sport, leisure, or fishing. Services include concessions, bait, and propane. Details at monkeyduckmarina.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Edges and edging can be found throughout nature. Great landscaping successfully duplicates nature on a smaller scale. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, GLT's Mike McCurdy and ISU's Patrick Murphy talk about how edging can separate some areas and bring others together.
It's human nature to separate, sort, and categorize. In landscaping, separating can be pleasing to the eye and functional. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University's School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, thanks for stopping by.
Nice to be with you, Mike.
And we're talking about landscaping edging.
Yeah.
Does the human eye just sort of like these areas of demarcation?
I think it does like it. Or it recognizes it. So I think about on our travels in life, say if you're traveling out to the mountains, east or west of where we're at right now, there comes to the point where you can see the mountains and you can see where the mountains rise up out of the earth, where the trees stop. And if it's high enough, you can see where the snow starts. And I think that part of recognizing and relishing that beauty is because of those layers. You can make that out. You can understand what's going on there. And I think the same is true in reverse. So if you're traveling out, say, to go to Palm Desert, California, there's going to be this part where you see the entire valley, which is like an oasis. So it's the other way around. You see the mountaintops with the snow, and then there's a line there, and then it's bare. And then there's some cacti and some palms. And then there's green lushness with water, and they all have boundaries and edges. And I think that that's something that's appreciated in art and just when we're gazing on nature.
So why do we separate and edge areas in our planned landscaping? Practical reasons, aesthetic reasons?
I think it is our way of making our part of the world more manageable, and we're also usually copying something we've seen. We may be on the lesser creative side and just copying what our neighbors do. But for those of us that are, let's call ourselves more advanced gardeners and landscapers, we're copying what we've seen in nature and what we've seen great gardeners and great landscapers do, which is typically copying nature. And it helps us to manage the different departments or the different areas that make up our property, like our lawn to patio edge. And then these edges, they make our lives easier because they help with things like surface runoff control, so our sidewalk's not inundated with water, for example. And like I mentioned, the little low spot where there's water, that's the water feature in our yard that's wrapped with a planting area around it. So you're kind of framing it, and you're building those layers in your garden as edges.
It could be just as simple as keeping the mulch out of the grass, too.
That's right.
What kind of materials are we talking about for edging? It could be as simple as no materials, right? A spade edge?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, Mike, and that's one that's oftentimes overlooked. And when it's done correctly, man, it makes your life really easy, and it sure makes for a great presentation on planting areas as well as how you manage your turf. But we also have the concrete, cement, and asphalt that can be used as edging. Usually the asphalt would be a driveway or a path or something, but you can actually have extruded concrete cement curbs. I've seen this a lot in the southeast, down in beach country, if you will. And then here in the Midwest, it's more common to see things like brick, metal, repurposed materials, even plastic edging. Plastic edging initially was designed as a way to allow people to transition into a permanent edge later, and they might not be able to afford it the day the landscaping is installed. And then you can install the brick or stone in front of that plastic, then remove the plastic, and then your new landscaping comes right up to this fashionable constructed edge.
Can we agree, though, that the plastic landscaping shouldn't be permanent? It just doesn't work very well for very long.
I think a lot of people didn't know that it was originally something that was a backyard product, if you will, and it was something that, like we're talking, it was a construction phase material. And in the Midwest, it's a pain in the neck because it just doesn't stay put.
It heaves in the winter.
But so does bender board and metal. So if you have those in your landscape, those edges are high maintenance, where the brick and even the concrete boulders, stones, they don't heave as much, and you can install them in a way that you don't have to do a lot of detailed edging with a string trimmer or power edger.
So before edging, you need to have areas that need to be edged or separated. Does that make sense? You need to have sort of a layout or design. What do you want to say about that?
I think that when you have all the areas of your landscape kind of coalesce, so areas being, say, driveways, walkways, patios, then you have lawns, and then in between those, you have planting areas that give you polite separations and give you privacy from your neighbors and frame your house. Sometimes there are lots of edges there that are really ornate and detailed, and that's on the higher end maintenance end of things. Other times they're more casual, like this. That's one of the reasons I love the spade edges. You see this nice transition from the trees to the shrubs down to the lawn, and you can flip it over and do it the other way as you get close to the house, and then it all matches in that case too.
What about duplicating the angles and curves that you see in nature?
Sweeping arcs and tangents are, I think, something that we like and we recognize when we see them, and that's why they're duplicated. In the landscape, they look best and they're easiest to build when they're true. So what I mean by that is a curve, for example, would be a segment of a circle where you know its center. So you can, from the origin of the circle, you can mark the arcs and then have these nice true curves that transition and in straight lines or right angles into their finishing or completion areas. And the eye recognizes them more readily when they're true. When they're contrived, and I use the example of the Nike swoosh. We love it, but I don't want to see it in my landscaping necessarily.
Does edging always have to be thought of as a separation, or can it be a way to sort of ease disparate areas in the landscaping, transitioning from a patio to turf, for instance?
Yeah, I think it could easily be something that is like a meshing or a combining of two areas. So the turf to patio transition that you mentioned, it's really nice and pretty important, actually, that it's an effortless transition. You have either a step going down onto the lawn and a step coming back onto the patio, or no step either way. So if it's off a little bit and it's 2 or 3 inches below the patio, when you step off the patio, you don't notice it. But if you don't remember that, when you're coming back, you catch the end of your foot and you spill your drink, and nobody likes that.
I also think of edge as a verb. For instance, I have to edge the yard or the turf. These transition areas need to be maintained. Are we talking about a string trimmer in some cases? And do you have any tips if a string trimmer comes into play here?
I like to use the string trimmer as little as possible. You know, I was really glad when the battery-powered ones came out so I wouldn't have to suck exhaust in the whole time. But when we do our edges properly, a lot of times the lawnmower can take care of what you've had to do with the string trimmer in the past. There's exceptions to that, right? So if you've got a rocky edge somewhere that's butting up to the turf, and there's no built or constructed edge like brick pavers or flagstone or anything, that might require some string trimming. I personally like to keep that to a minimum. You don't have to do all that edging every time you mow anyway. But when edges are built and constructed so that the edge of the mower can ride right over the top of it, so that could be brick paver edging, for example, or it could even be where your turf hits the sidewalk at your house. Some people use the power edger, which is like a blade that vertically cuts this beautiful wall. So you see, right, the turf ends and the sidewalk begins.
And what about maintaining a spade edge? Can you do that with a string trimmer every now and then, or do you have to just go back in and use a spade every time?
You could use a string trimmer, but the spade is preferred. And, you know, gardening tools are fascinating. They now have, it looks like a draw knife on a long handle, so you can pull a hoe-shaped implement up against your edge to get that nice, crisp divot.
If you have any questions about landscaping or gardening, including edging, send them in, and Patrick Murphy with ISU School of Biological Sciences will answer them. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your questions to wglt.org/grow.
You can hear Grow most Wednesdays on Sound Ideas. Subscribe to the podcast at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Black Dirt Music Festival founder Edward David Anderson says the outdoor July Fest next to the Castle Theater is intended to celebrate the best features of Bloomington Normal. The fest includes a reunion of Anderson's backyard tire fire, which disbanded in 2011. Anderson tells GLT's John Norton the all-local lineup of Backyard Tire Fire, Chicago Farmer, Black Dirt Revival, Matthew Curry, and John Till was intentional.
Yes, especially for this first one, we wanted it to represent this community. You know, we want this to be a community thing. We want this to be a family-friendly event. This is an outdoor show. You know, this is fun. You know, this is something that we want the whole community to kind of rally around, you know, at least the whole music community. We'd love to get people that aren't even, you know, maybe don't even know who any of these acts are. They're still going to enjoy this, sitting outside and listening to good music in downtown Bloomington, you know.
Well, let's go with the bands then. And one of the bands that'll be appearing is the reunion of Backyard Tire Fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Why?
Well, you know what? It's interesting. When we first developed the concept of the festival and we were talking to the Castle about it, and to be brutally honest, I hadn't listened to any of the Tire Fire material in a long time. I hadn't, I don't really play a ton of it. You know, I wrote a bunch of new songs that kind of moved on, and I had never made a Spotify playlist in my life, and my wife was showing me how to do it, and I found a couple Backyard Tire Fire records on Spotify. And so I made a Spotify playlist of some of my three solo records and then a couple of Tire Fire records kind of mixed in. And I started hearing these songs kind of back to back, and I started getting nostalgic for these old songs that I had written. I mean, they're really, at the time, they meant everything to me. You know, they were the story of my life. They are the story of my life, basically. So I hadn't played them in so long, and I got nostalgic, and I really wanted to play them again. And that's kind of how the whole thing started.
Well, and you've done your solo thing for the last number of years now. And yeah. By the way, these are great albums you're putting out as solo albums. You probably couldn't have done this. You couldn't have redone Backyard Tire Fire 3 years ago then. You weren't ready yet.
No, I wasn't really. And I think that it just seemed like the right time. I don't know. Just hearing those songs and hearing them with my new songs just kind of made me just want to play them again, really. And I felt like at that moment, I kind of suggested to my wife, I was like, well, what would you think that if, and she's like, wow, I mean, I think that'd be a great way to kick this whole festival thing off. The first year you guys come back and do a set.
For anyone not knowing, maybe you're new to town, Backyard Tire Fire was a nationally touring band. You guys were playing with major names across the country. They disbanded, what, 2011 you guys kind of disbanded?
Yeah, you know, we the last year of our existence, I think we played a handful of gigs. We were trying to settle up some debts and stuff. And, I mean, it's been almost a decade since we played regularly together.
Is Tim playing with you, too?
Yeah, and my brother and Scott Tipping on guitar. And, yeah, really?
Oh, this will be great.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun.
Hey, it's okay, it's all right.
Hey, It's good to be. It's a classic Backyard Tire Fire cut here on GLT Sound Ideas. Our guest is Edward David Anderson, who is reuniting the band for the Black Dirt Music Festival. It'll be in downtown Bloomington in July. Chicago Farmer's on the bill.
Yep.
You can't play without Chicago Farmer. I mean, you guys are like right arm, left arm, aren't you?
Yeah, we do a good bit of gigging together, although it's been a little bit since, you know, since we went down to the beach last winter, and I may have played a gig with him since I've been back, maybe not. So it's been a little while, so it'll be fun to kind of reconnect.
Well, Cody, Chicago Farmer's billed with friends.
Yes.
Who are some of those friends?
Wildermore.
Are you serious?
Wildermore is back in Farmer. It's going to be really cool.
I've been on them to put out a new album, for
yeah,
God's sake.
I know. Yeah. They're so good. They're just a really good band, and I think they're going to be great doing the Farmer material. They're really good at learning other people's stuff. I mean, God, when they cover the Bowie stuff or the Who stuff,
yeah.
How great were they?
That was fantastic.
They obviously have great songs themselves and stuff, but they're really, really accomplished guys that can play, and so I really am excited to hear what they do behind Chicago Farmer.
Well, I know Matthew Curry's trying to make a go of it nationally. He's on the bill, and you're probably sick of me talking about this, how especially you and Cody are getting credited with kind of just rounding up everybody in this community and making it a real cohesive, you know, united music scene.
Sure.
Matthew Curry is from here, but he's, you know, he's touring nationally and stuff, but he's in a different generation than you guys are as well. Well, let me ask it this way. How important is it for a local scene to be able to help each other out and maybe boost each other up, whether, say, I mean, you tour nationally as well.
Sure.
So if you're out on the road, Cody's out on the road.
Yeah.
Talking about the Bloomington Normal music scene, does that happen, and how important is that to help what's going on in town here?
I think it really does, and you know what, a lot of it comes back to the castle. We've talked about it a lot, but like, you know, we'll be out, I'll be somewhere in a different time zone and mention, you know, Bloomington, and be like, someone might be like, is that where that Castle Theater is? You know, like, it's starting to, it's kind of getting known, not just in the Midwest, but nationally. There's a lot of bands coming through here that are really digging that venue, and that's helping kind of put it on the map. And then, yeah, I always kind of talk about, you know, who comes from this town and the people that are out doing it, and try to, you know, pump up what we have going on in this little scene here, you know. And I think Cody does. I'm sure everybody does. I'm sure everybody's out there that's from this town mentioning the other acts that are also from this town that are out there doing it on the national level. It only helps, you know. You know, I'm all about working together and trying to help other people get seen, or helping someone that's working hard at it, that's doing it for the right reasons. I want people to know who they are. I mean, that's, I feel like the more the merrier.
On the banks of the Mackinac, as I threw in a line, almost heard my daddy call, son, you get back sometime. To the great Midwest, where things seem real, the great Midwest.
New song from Matthew Curry, The Great Midwest, here on GLT Sound Ideas. We're talking about July's Black Dirt Music Festival with founder Edward David Anderson. On the bill, Backyard Tire Fire, Chicago Farmer, Edward David Anderson, and Black Dirt Revival. That's one band. Mm-hmm. Matthew Curry and John Till.
Yeah.
John's been not been part of this conversation so far.
Yeah.
Why is John on the bill?
Because I love John.
Yeah, he's so much
he's
fun.
He's such a good guy, and
a very talented guy.
Yeah, I love what he does. He's a very humble young man, and
he's another guy that is an amazing talent.
Yeah, he gets out there and does it Midwestern, and he's a hard-working young guy, and I love the tunes. I had a really good time when we, you know, worked together on that album, and that was one of the first records that I really got to get my hands on and produce just by myself, and I really enjoyed making that record. And I felt like John, you know, as far as Black Dirt music, I mean, he actually works on a farm. His last name is Till. You know, like, he's as Black Dirt as you can get. So he felt like the right way to kick off the festival would be John to do his one-man band thing.
Da-da-da-da-da.
So we talked a little bit about the local scene, and we talked off and on over the years about how it's Bloomington Normal is really bubbling up. There's really something going on here. How much does this add to the scene?
I think it's huge, man. I think that if we can make this
outside the city?
Yeah, I think that if we can make this a thing where we have people travel. I know for a fact there are people that are flying in and driving in from all over the place because of this tire fire thing, because we haven't played in almost a decade, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, next year it's going to be bigger, and there'll probably be some bigger acts, some very known things happening on it as well. I want people to come from all over the place to this town. I want this to help the local economy. I want this to be a thing that grows into a regular, you know, an annual thing that grows into this, you know, this destination where people are going to come to Bloomington every year and go to the Black Dirt Music Festival. One thing that I think that we're really excited about is that a portion of this year's proceeds are going to Habitat for Humanity in McLean County, which is really exciting for us as we want this to be a community-based thing. We want this to be a point of pride for the community. This is something that's going to be a very positive experience for everybody, not just the musicians, not just the music lovers that already go to the castle, but I think that if we can get more people outside of this little music community in the greater community involved, we could really have something special here.
Black Dirt Music Festival founder Edward David Anderson speaking with GLT's John Norton. The Black Dirt Music Festival is July 27th outdoors in the Castle Rock Lot in downtown Bloomington. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org, and with story contributions from Charlie Schlenker, Eric Stock, John Norton, and our WCBU colleague Tim Shelley. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.